The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, Tim.
Happy February.
Happy February. Yes, Punxsutawney Phil and Buckeye Chuck. Buckeye Chuck bit the guy.
No. That was from Wisconsin. Don't blame the Buckeyes.
Hey, you know what? These poor rodents, why don't they just leave them alone?
Let them go, right?
I think they should just let them sleep, you know? It doesn't make any difference. It's cold. It's snowy. I had to dig out a whole bunch of times this past week. Whatever. So it's going to be a jam-packed show this evening. We want to get right to it. Yesterday at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time, WJCU opened its magic website to accept your pledges to support the station, programming, and the work of the Outspoken Cyclist.
And we get to be here two weekends in a row, right?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. We will be answering the phones this evening, 5:30 to 6:30. This show is pre-recorded, so we can take your calls. We will be here next Saturday, also from 5:30 to 6:30, if you don't do it this week. But I'll beat you up a little bit, you know, during the show, so maybe you will. As you are listening, please consider reaching into your pocket purse, man purse, backpack, bike bag, or whatever place you keep your credit cards or wallet, and log on to our station, WJCU.org. Click the Radiothon link. Show us your appreciation and support, not to mention your love, for the work we do to bring you fresh, fun, poignant, interesting, and informative content each week, which is what we try to do.
Yes.
Yes, we do. You can also pick up the phone and call 216-397-4438. Again, you can call probably any time all week, 5:30 to 6:30 this evening. We will be answering the phones, Tim and I. Next Saturday, we'll be answering the phones. But if you want to call, 216-397-4438. Personally, I would like to just say that we only come to you once a year. It is a short window of time. We ask for your support for our work. If you like what we do, we would appreciate your support. We are a non-commercial, publicly supported station. We're on the campus of John Carroll University in University Heights, Ohio. This station affords us the opportunity to bring you the Outspoken Cyclist every week with a state-of-the-art facility. It was built with funds raised from previous Radiothon events. And if you like what we do, consider pledging to our cause. Whether it's $5, whether it's $500, every dollar goes to keep our station on the air with the best quality equipment and programming anywhere. What?
You're doing great. I didn't want to interrupt.
I've said my piece. But we do have to begin our show this evening. It's a short conversation we're going to have with our friend Shannon Galpin. Shannon is really one of the truly good guys. She's a selfless activist focused on helping the young women of Afghanistan and elsewhere in the world whose voices may not be heard and whose progress is thwarted by any of a number of antiquated and appalling circumstances. This past week, Shannon posted the following comment on her Facebook page, which is why I wanted to talk with her again. Quote, funding for Afghan cycling team is canceled because the company involved has changed its mind and is now too risk averse to do a story about Muslims after the Paris attacks, even positive ones like female cyclists that risk their lives to ride a bike. I was just crushed. I could not believe she was so upset. In addition, she penned a really beautiful, heartfelt, and candid essay on the adventure-journal.com website, calling for more bravery and honesty to counter the cowardly acts by the Islamic terrorists. I wanted to know who would back away from these Afghan women. Who would back away and pull their support? Why there is so much fear when the women who should be the ones who are terrified, but yet they're the ones who are willing to risk it all to ride a bike and demand more freedoms. I just don't understand.
I think we kind of, in the United States, we're spoiled with how wonderful we have things. Yes, we have a lot of problems and we have a lot of issues, but we can't imagine what it would be like for all the things that they're going through. And it's, as you said earlier, it's wonderful how she steps up and puts herself in there to get it moving forward.
Well, we'll see what she has to say. We're going to also jump over the pond. We're going to speak with Dr. Paul Demio. This past week, Paul, whose main areas of research, interest, and expertise relate to drug use in sport and anti-doping policy, published an article on the website The Conversation titled, ready for this, Forget Lance Armstrong. The next big cycling doper could be your dad. And it just, I'm like, okay, I got to read this. So it grabbed my attention. I shot off an email to Paul to find out more about his work. Dr. Demio was a visiting Fulbright Commission scholar at the University of Texas in Austin from September to December of 2012. He worked on a project titled The Doping of Elite Athletes in International Sport and the Politics of the Cold War, 1950 through 1990. He will be talking about that this evening. It's a very interesting topic. He published an award-winning monograph titled A History of Drug Use in Sport, 1876 to 1976, Beyond Good and Evil, in the year of 2007. Now, isn't that kind of interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll hear what he has to say. I figured he might be just the right person to shed light on why an amateur might use drugs and why pros are still showing up with positive drug tests all over the place. Anyway, finally, we're going to welcome back author, coach, and senior athlete Joe Friel. He will be talking about his new book, Fast After 50, How to Race Strong for the Rest of Your Life. Even if you're actually not racing your bike or running a marathon or running a triathlon with the hopes of an age win or a personal best, there is much to be said for a book that explains how and why we tend to slow down with age and how we can mitigate some of the things that happen to us with a little attention to what we eat, what we weigh, and how we manage our active lives. We might have some news, but probably not. Maybe if we have some time. But let's get right to it and find out Shannon Galpin's situation with her Afghan women's cycling team. Shannon, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Yeah, it is my pleasure. So I read an alarming post from you this week. I wanted to know if you would fill us in on what's happened with the sponsorship of the Afghan women's cycling team.
Well, as people probably aren't familiar, there's very little support for the team financially. We have a couple major partners with Live Cycling and Osprey Packs who have been fabulous and are continuing to support these amazing girls. But we had two European partners, and that was kind of constituting the bulk of the programming for this year. It had two overseas trips, some training, some exhibition rides, as well as financial support that would have supported all their racing and travel for the year. And both have recently pulled their support in the past week.
What are they giving as reasons for pulling their support from this cause? It just doesn't make sense to me.
No, it's fascinating. In both cases, it's a backlash based upon fear after the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, which I find fascinating because, obviously, one, completely unrelated. It's a sports team. They're not, wearing the image of Prophet Muhammad or doing anything that's considered at all controversial in that manner. And at the same time, when we see Malala, stepping to the world stage as a Nobel Peace Prize winner and someone who's a huge inspiration to the world, and she's the counterpoint of these girls. She has come from a similar region just across the border in Pakistan from these young girls in Afghanistan.
I think it's sending the wrong kind of message.
Oh, definitely.
I just am trying to wrap my head around the idea that these companies would use the French bombings as a reason when you know, these women are willing to risk everything. You know, it's not like they're really risking anything.
No, that's the irony. It's this self-censoring based on a perceived threat or fear, or and most, I think, importantly, because these are companies, a perceived controversy. You know, could this be spun the wrong way? And yet this is controversial in that these girls are risking their lives to ride their bikes, but it's inspirational. And, you know, it is the epitome of courage and bravery and inspiring sports stories. And yet these girls face disappointment after disappointment after disappointment. And this, you know, having to send a note to the team and say, you know, these trips that we were planning on this year, yeah, they're not happening. And I'm going to have to hustle to try to find the funding to even send you to the races we were planning. I mean, these girls are coming from Afghanistan, where they have zero support really in the country, and having support from outside the country means everything.
Sure. Are you still going to be able to bring girls to the RAGBRAI event?
Yeah, because that's a separate funding issue. That is through Shirzanon, which is a magazine, a media publication about Muslim female athletes. So it's a goal to bring over a variety of girls from different countries. And hopefully one of these girls will be one of the ones that we can bring. But, you know, what they need most is coaching and training and exposure to racing. And that all takes money, you know, like any team.
So let me ask a question about Afghanistan itself. You know, the U.S. is pulling their troops. And I wanted to know, do you think it's become more dangerous, more conservative since the escalation of ISIL, ISIS, whatever they are, and the Charlie Hebdo bombings? Has there been a change?
Well, in Afghanistan, the biggest change that has been happening over the last couple of years has been unrelated to ISIS in particular. It was more about the U.S. troops pulling out, the presidential elections happening, and then a very long, protracted election, you know, with an undecided vote and, you know, shared government control, all of which lends to a more unstable environment. And women are at the front lines of that. No matter what they're doing, just based upon the very fact of their gender, they are more at risk when there's instability. Now you throw in ISIS, and we have seen in Pakistan and Afghanistan that they are starting to infiltrate, and that is incredibly scary because, you know, in some respects, they make the Taliban look like pussycats.
Will you still be able to travel to Afghanistan, or is that going to be curtailed?
I think that still remains to be seen. I am certainly feeling like I am near my particular, you know, barrier, you know, risk assessment barrier, mainly because I have, you know, a 10-year-old daughter, and I need to make sure that I'm always assessing my own personal risk and also making sure that I don't ever put the Afghan girls at more risk, that I give them the support that I can without increasing their risk. My goal is to mitigate their risk.
So here's the question that I have for you. A, what are your plans? And B, is there something we as supporters of your cause, Mountain to Mountain, the Afghan women's cycling team, the movie, all these amazing things that you're doing, is there something that we can do that these sponsors might look at and say, gee, maybe I better grow a pair, you know, and step up, you know?
Well, I think certainly, you know, when this podcast comes out, when people look at the Adventure Journal essay that I wrote today that kind of lays this all out in detail with some photos, that there's a link they can share. They can talk about how inspired they are by these women. They can, you know, post it on social media. That sort of stuff does actually get attention because at the end of the day, the sponsors that do support us, Live Cycling and Osprey Packs and Scratch Labs, you know, they're looking at, oh, great, you know, we're supporting a team that is inspiring people. So it helps solidify our relationship with our existing partners, but also makes those that are backing down maybe think twice, especially as I'm looking at bringing them to Europe and hopefully to America. And, you know, they're kind of missing out on those opportunities, on some very high profile events that, you know, we will find the money somehow. We always do.
We will do what we can. I really, really wanted to talk to you, and I'm glad you found some time for me today. I appreciate it.
I'm so grateful to be able to even just talk about this with the audience and know that, yeah, as the documentary Afghan Cycles comes out next year, we'll be able to share this story much louder.
Right.
But for now, I think it's a matter of everyone who understands the bike represents freedom and that these girls are brave beyond measure, braver than anyone I've ever met in the sporting world. You know, we need to support them, and we need to step up when things like this happen.
Well, thank you so much. Keep your chin up. I think good things will happen. They're right around the corner.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Have a great evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Shannon Galpin joined me actually from her car. She is taking her daughter to a basketball game, I think. She's in Breckenridge, Colorado, and holy smokes, two people's pulled sponsorship. I'm really kind of sad about that.
Well, hopefully we can get word out and that may change or someone else may step up.
That would be really nice. We are going to take a really, really quick break. In the meantime, I also want to remind you that the portal is open for you to pledge. Radiothon today, WJCU.org, or you can call 216-397-4438. We are happy to take your money to support our cause. We will be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist. So I hope you picked up your credit card and made your pledge. We need to rush on over to the UK. We are going to speak with Dr. Paul Demio about doping in sport from a very scientific and professional point of view. But he's a lot of fun. Hi, Paul. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So I read your article last week, and it really caught my attention. It was a conversation titled, Forget Lance Armstrong, the next big doper could be your dad. We've discussed doping on this show. In fact, many of our listeners say we discuss it too much, but I think you have a perspective that is really, really important. Tell us a little bit about you and your research and your background.
I've really been in universities. I became a professor, well, what we would call a lecturer, junior lecturer, back in 1999 and around about 2004, 2005. And I was teaching in universities and doing research in essentially sports sociology. And I started to read around drugs and sport because I was interested in this dilemma between sport as performance and achievement, and on the other hand, sport as kind of health and recreation. So the drugs question to me seemed to be on that kind of knife edge, if you like, between what was valuable and good and ethical about sport, but also what kind of tipped people into more deviant behaviour. So I started to look for histories. I was interested in tracing how we got to the position we're into today. And I became a little bit frustrated because there was many things which I was reading which didn't have a great deal of evidence. So often I would read that in the 19th century, swimmers and runners and cyclists all used cocaine and heroin and strychnine, but there was never any reference to primary sources, any original documentation. So I set off trying to find that, and then I was also became interested in who started anti-doping, whose idea was it to stop people from using drugs, and which drugs were seen as problematic and why. So I pieced essentially to those two elements and wrote a book in 2007. Which covered the time period from 1876 to 1976. And the reason that stopped then was that 1976 was the year of the first Olympic testing for steroids. So we'd reached a point quite quickly from probably the early 1960s where people were unsure how to deal with drugs to the point in 1976 where we see the regulation which we're all quite familiar with today.
I know people were smoking and they were drinking, but I didn't realize they were doing drugs like heroin and cocaine. And we're talking way before what we would have thought. What do you think made the athletes make these choices even then? So there has to be something in the psyche of these athletes that make them want to compete at a level that needs some enhancement, yes?
Well, I suppose I would qualify that by saying it's not a great deal of evidence that they were. There's some evidence, but it's quite patchy. So beyond that, I would say that in the late 19th and early 20th century, heroin and cocaine were seen as quite normal. There was no restriction against their use. And the same can be said of amphetamines in 1940s and 1950s. So when drugs were quite normal in society, then, you know, there's nothing wrong with doing them in sport. So in some ways, we can't really call that doping because there was no understanding of it as a problematic activity. So when you ask me why they might take cocaine and heroin, I would probably have to reply and say, well, why not? If lots of other people were taking those drugs in society, then it would be quite normal for sportsmen to do so.
That's interesting. So that makes perfect sense. So, you know, it's sort of like, well, he drinks beer or he, you know, drinks bourbon or whatever. It's the same thing then.
Well, basically, quite a lot of famous people in that time period, you know, said that those drugs were acceptable. So Sigmund Freud was one. He wrote a short essay on cocaine, quite a positive sort of sense, that I think Coca-Cola originally had some cocaine in it. Sherlock Holmes, in the very first story of Sherlock Holmes, he was seen injecting heroin, which led him to solve the case.
Right, the 7% solution.
That's right.
I remember that.
There's an element of, you know, acceptability, especially if it's normal, if it's gentrified, you know, if it's, you know, middle class, well-behaved, civilized people, then those sorts of drugs are not really seen as problematic. It's only really opium, when opium becomes associated with so-called untrustworthy sections of the population, that we then begin to see an element of prohibition, and that's really into the 1920s and 1930s.
I see. Let's fast forward to the article you wrote about, you know, that the next person who could be doing EPO might be your dad. So I guess one of the questions that comes up for me, that first of all, a Grand Fondo is a timed event, but it's not a competitive event. Why would some middle-aged guy risk his health to take EPO at a Grand Fondo? And then also, why would USADA want to test a Grand Fondo? These people aren't competing for money.
So the guys who tested positive for EPO in 2012 did actually win their categories. So there is an element of some sort of success that they were aiming towards. So I guess that you could separate or distinguish between those people who maybe wish to find some way of enhancing their performance because they may actually win something. So that's a first group of people. And we could question that because they're not going to win money. But what they are going to do is achieve some sort of fame or status within their community. So I could possibly understand or I could see some extrinsic value to taking EPO in that situation. I guess the more challenging one is those people who will never be placed, who will never be in a top 10, who are really doing it for their own pride. And that becomes harder to understand because what is the difference between coming 500th and 470th? It doesn't really make much difference. But I guess what happens is people, it's not just in cycling, it's in lots of other sports, triathlon, Ironman, running. You know, they have a sense of what they want to achieve. And even if for the outside world and the rest of their athletic community, they're not achieving a great deal. They actually want to achieve something for themselves. And I can't really speak from a great deal of experience. I have only, I ran a marathon in 2011. I was really, really disappointed with my time. And I was never going to be anywhere near the leaders. And I wouldn't take drugs in order to improve my time. But I do remember that sense of dissatisfaction at not achieving what I'd hoped to achieve. So I guess it could be intrinsic in some sense of identity, some sense of self-worth that people are driving towards, which isn't really about becoming the gold medal winner or even a silver medal winner, but it's about what they want to achieve in their sporting performance.
That's the athlete himself making that choice, or herself. But what about USADA? Why would they get into doping? First of all, it's expensive to test. You know, it's random testing. And I do know they've caught people and they've disqualified them. But why are they taking the time to test in an amateur event like a Grand Fondo?
Well, that's a good question. I think, obviously, most people like to think that competitions are clean. And even if the competition is not that serious, then, you know, it doesn't look good for the organisers of the competition or the other athletes if people know that others in the field are taking those drugs. And then other people might think, well, it's an open field and other people are doing it, so I need to do it. So therefore, I guess it becomes a bigger problem if, you know, it's easy for a small problem in doping to become a bigger problem. Now, USADA have a product, and it's the same here in the UK and European countries. They have a difficulty because they have very limited resources and they simply cannot test all those people. They also run up against this problem of out-of-competition testing because it's almost impossible to imagine an out-of-competition testing system for Grand Fondos, for mass participation races. That is clearly not going to happen. So anyone who knows anything can take steroids or EPO or growth hormone or something and ensure that they're off, it's out of their system before the event. So in actual fact, in competition testing isn't really going to solve the problem if there is a problem. So there's all these dilemmas. And my understanding of the US cycling community is that USADA will not pay for testing at non-elite events or amateur events. So people are some community groups are raising their own money in order to help pay for testing at amateur events.
Huh.
Which is really interesting, you know, because I've never heard of that anywhere else in the world. And it becomes this quite interesting sort of mutual suspicion and surveillance of each other, even though, as you say, the stakes are not very high. It's a very interesting social phenomenon, I think.
It's very strange. I'm speaking with Dr. Paul Demio. He is at the Stirling University in the UK. His specialty is talking about doping in sports. And I think you do some consulting in that regard, yes?
Well, a little bit, yes. A little bit.
I want to know if you think that the whole doping thing, which obviously no matter how much testing and the biological passport and all the things that have been put in place at the professional level, doesn't seem to stop people from doping. I mean, Astana every week for 5 weeks had somebody, you know, test positive. It's just ridiculous. How has it changed the sports, do you think?
Okay, so I think cycling is interesting because they do seem to have made a lot of headway. So if we go back 10 years or 15 years, I think most people would accept there was a major doping problem. What they seem to have been able to do was to stop doping at the level of team management. So I think most team managers or team owners would now be anti-doping, would want to make sure as far as possible that their riders are clean. And they've done that through really draconian measures, you know, lots more testing, the biological passport, and sticking to the policy of banning riders who test positive, even if it's in, like in Contador's case, it was quite a, and a small amount of clenbuterol. So now they've moved to a four-year ban. And for a cyclist, a four-year ban is probably going to threaten their career. So again, if we trace back to the early 2000s, most cyclists were managing to convince the authorities to keep their bans to 1 year or less. So now a four-year ban is probably has to be taken more seriously. So there's lots of interesting things about cycling, and I think the US postal case is really fascinating about how that blend of individual confessions, of the federal inquiry, of the role of the sponsors and the role of the media all combined together to end up with the 2012 reasoned decision and Lance Armstrong being stripped of his titles. It seems to have had an effect on the younger generation, where young cyclists coming through don't feel the need to dope quite so much, and there are teams which are explicitly anti-doping. But your question about Astana is really interesting. So how, given that environment and the pressure that teams are under and individual cyclists are under, why is it there still seems to be some ongoing issues and some people who are still tempted to dope? And I don't really have an answer, because the only answer I can give is that the motivations to dope are still the same. So if an athlete in any sport believes that they need some form of performance enhancement and they feel they could possibly get away with it, i.e. they won't be caught, the system's not tight enough to catch them, some way of avoiding being caught, then, you know, why not? Why would you not dope if, you know, you could make a career or you could become first rather than second if you thought that other people were doping? It's all that combination of factors that come together. And so some of those have changed in cycling, but not all of them. And I would say that it does seem to me that we're in an interesting phase in cycling, because like Lance Armstrong said last week, that he doesn't really believe things have changed at the highest level as much as they should have. So it will be interesting to see if the UCI can actually keep up the momentum which Travis Tiger and USADA, you know, really have created.
So my last question is, do you think certain policies should be put in place? What kinds of policies do you think might work? Are they necessary? Is it really going to change anything to put more policies in place, is a better question, I think.
I guess, in my view, there's always this blend of hard policies and soft policies. So the hard policies now seem to be in place, which is the, as I say, the longer ban, more testing. And there's a kind of social stigma which is attached to doping now. So it's very difficult now for cyclists who are being caught doping to, you know, basically say, well, it's part of the sport. It's the, what they used to say. So I would say things have changed and there's been a cultural change. But if there's going to be anything to add to that, it's probably a kind of softer, more preemptive type of policy, where there's maybe more education, where education is based on ethics rather than just, you know, information about what's banned and what's not banned. And maybe some sort, it's been mentioned already by one of your counterparts who runs a website called The Outer Line, that there's like an accreditation scheme. So in order to be part of a team, a cyclist would have to show that they've been through anti-doping training, that the team management would have to show that they're doing proactive anti-doping work, and therefore the team has to have that accreditation before it can be accepted into the main races. And so that kind of softer, more kind of structured, supportive type of system might be a useful addition to the tougher, kind of harder, more draconian sanctions which are currently in place.
So what is your next, where are you going next with your research and your conversation?
Well, I have been working on a little bit further on amateur doping cases in amateur US cycling with some colleagues. And we did a survey actually last year of all USA cycling members. So I'm just beginning to analyze the results of that.
That'll be interesting.
Yeah, well,
maybe.
Hopefully. Hopefully it will be. And I'm also interested in just, I've been doing some historical research with colleagues at the University of Texas. So quite interested in why, I guess historically, why America was so slow and passive during the 1970s and 1980s and arguably into the 1990s. And perhaps that could be linked to the nationalistic policies, politics of the Cold War period, where it was perhaps seen as more important to keep up with the Soviets and the East Germans and ensure that those battles were won rather than worrying too much about the ethics. And just find that time period really, really fascinating. As I say, it strikes that dilemma, strikes at the heart of that dilemma between performance sport and ethical or healthy sport. So those are the sort of projects which I'm working on. I have a few grad students working on different types of issues around anti-doping policy and, you know, some critical aspects, because I guess there's some unethical aspects to anti-doping. For example, issues around privacy. So doing urine and blood testing to me, or to some people, is an invasion of privacy. And it's an interesting question one of my students is looking at as to how athletes themselves respond to that particular issue. Do they see it as a necessary evil, or do they feel embarrassed when they have to urinate in front of a stranger in order to provide a sample? So I do. There's lots of aspects of anti-doping which I'm finding very interesting just now, both kind of historically and contemporary.
Well, I find it fascinating too. I'll be interested to hear the analysis on the survey you did with the USA Cycling people, and I'd like to be able to come back to you and hear some more if that's okay with you.
Oh, it would be a pleasure to speak to you again. Thanks very much for the invitation.
And thank you so much for talking with me today. You have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Dr. Paul DiMeo joined me from his office at Stirling University in the UK. What an interesting conversation. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist. And once again, while we're on break, WJCU.org or 216-397-4438, and make your pledge during our very short window of Radiothon. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
We are going to head on down to Joe Friel's office and talk with him about his new book, Fast After 50, How to Race Strong for the Rest of Your Life. And it's not all about racing. It's about staying strong. It's about staying healthy. Joe Friel, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thanks, Diane. Glad to be here.
Your new book, I think a lot of our listeners are going to be interested and excited about it, especially me, Fast After 50, How to Race Strong for the Rest of Your Life. And you know, while it's essentially about competing, I think there is a lot to be learned by all of us about staying healthy and active and strong in everything that you've said. I'd like to know about a decline in our ability. Is it inevitable as we get older for our ability to perform to decline?
Yeah, it seems to be. I think the only issue we're talking about here is what's the rate of decline as opposed to whether or not there's going to be a decline. I've never known of anybody to maintain their performance levels for, you know, 30, 40, 50 years in any endurance sport. That would be a first. But But you can certainly slow down the rate of decline, and the research shows that quite convincingly, that training with intensity is what the research has always shown, tends to reduce the decline to something in the neighborhood of about 0.5% per year, whereas training the long, slow distance, there's about a 1% decline per year. And people become extremely sedentary, there's more like a 1.5% decline in performance over the course of time.
If we look at that and we say each increment is 50% less or more, depending on whether you're going for the, you know, more sedentary, less sedentary, what are the opportunities that could lie ahead of us as we age, instead of looking at it as, oh my God, I'm getting older and I should expect these horrible things to happen?
Yeah, there are several, actually. One is that we get smarter, I think, in many ways, and probably it's just wisdom. We learn how to train, for one thing. When I talk with young athletes, they're totally confused about how to train. Everything is new to them. But when I talk with older athletes, they've been through this before, and they understand what it means to do certain types of workouts and so forth. And so their wisdom, I think, begins to pay off in terms of performance. Also, I think as we age, there's an increase in our patience. We become better at realizing it's going to take time to accomplish whatever it is we want to accomplish. Things don't happen overnight. We've kind of gotten used to that over the years, especially in the latter years, because it does take longer as we get older to see the changes take place. Whereas when we were younger, the changes could take place rather rapidly because we could do hard workouts very close to each other. Whereas we get older, we're not able to do that as much, and so we begin to learn patience, which I think is a great thing to have as an athlete also.
And I have to say, I have noticed that I do have more patience today than I did when I first started running in my, you know, in my 30s, because I started running late. So, you know, what's interesting in the book is, besides all of the information that you put in there, you reached out to a lot of prominent people like Mark Allen and Andy Pruitt and John Howard and Lisa Rainsberger. How was their input used to shape the content of the book? It's got some interesting ways of looking at all of these different issues of you know, getting faster after you're 50.
Yeah, that is exactly why I did it. You hit the nail on the head right there. I wanted to have someone, other people, in many cases were very well-known people, like Mark Allen, for example, give their input on some of the same topics I'm writing about, so that they give a different voice to the topic. And so all the way through the book, every chapter's got one or two contributors who are, for the most part, well-known people within their sports. And They help to kind of fill in, if you will, the gaps and the things that I was talking about, giving it from a more personal perspective. And all these contributors are over the age of 50. And so they're all talking about it from their perspective, their personal perspective of how they perceive aging and how they perceive performance now that they're in their 50s, some of whom were, you know, extremely good athletes, not that they're not anymore, but in the younger days, they were world-class athletes, in many cases, a John Howard, for example, in cycling, or Mark Allen in triathlon, or Lisa Rainsberger in marathon running. These are all people who have set the bar very high at one time in their lives, and now they can look back at that and see what it means to their life now that they're over the age of 50.
Exactly. And I know I've spoken with, you know, some of the older athletes over the years, but I found it really interesting. Dr. John Post talked about osteoarthritis, which is, in my case, from an injury and in my knee. What can be done to help mitigate some of the problems that crop up from aging and injury as it relates to arthritis? Now, I know there are some treatments I'm looking at, but to keep people moving, there are some things I think we can do. Yes.
Yeah, I think so. The first thing is, just as you mentioned, taking your doctor's guidance and following whatever methods of dealing with the issue the doctor suggests. But there are some things we can do also. There are going to be good days and bad days when you have arthritis. You know, the knee or the hip or whatever it may be is going to be a little more tender on some days than another. And so we need to pay close attention to that. It's also possible we can aggravate the arthritic joint by by doing workouts that have too great of what's called dose. In other words, the workout is too hard. And so we need to learn how to measure the dose for workouts so that we can not tax the joint excessively before it's ready for it. It will hopefully adapt over time if the doses are small enough, and if also the density, which is how much time there is between these hard workouts, is not too tight. In other words, we want to spread out the workouts as much as possible that are the challenging workouts. There's also some reason to believe that from the research that acidic versus alkaline diets may have some effect also on arthritis.
Like an anti-inflammation type diet?
Yeah, exactly. So a diet which is high in fruits and vegetables, for example, tends to be alkaline, which lowers the inflammations, or has the potential to lower the inflammation of joints in the body. And so that may be something the athlete considers also in terms of this whole big picture of it's everything. It's lifestyle, it's training, it's nutrition. All these things have to be taken into consideration when one is dealing with something like arthritis.
Well, one of the things that is mentioned that I think also might have some more to do with that same topic, but overall, is shedding body fat and regaining muscle density. I want to sort of address those two things about losing weight, obviously. Maybe it's not losing weight, but it's certainly losing the fat portion of the weight and then regaining muscle density. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Body weight is probably not a good measure of how we're doing as we get older. There can be a shift taking place between the ratio of muscle to fat, for example, and that may not be reflected on the bathroom scales. Muscle per unit weighs more than fat for the same unit. So consequently, you may be losing muscle but gaining fat, and the bathroom scales don't tell you the difference. But you should be able to tell it by simply paying attention to how arms, legs, and so forth feel. Measurements, for example, around the waist are probably one of the easiest indicators as we get beyond the age of 50 for how we're doing, both males and females, by the way. So we need to pay attention to what's going on with our bodies. And it may require, as we get older, that we shift our diet to something different. We may need to experiment a little bit with our diets. Athletes, as they get older, are experiencing some hormonal changes that can have a big impact on the body's propensity to store fat. And by shifting the diet, we may be able to change that. Now, that shift can be a number of things. The most common shift that seems to work for athletes is to move away from eating so much carbohydrate and eat more protein, especially. Protein has been shown to actually help to speed up the fat losing process, while also, by the way, building muscle. There's a hormonal effect from eating protein, apparently, which can be beneficial for both sides, both losing fat and gaining muscle. I just read a research study on that this morning. It just came out this year, in fact, and with the subjects that ate who did certain strength training, and then they also ate a certain amount of protein. The athletes who ate the most protein gained the most muscle compared to the athletes who didn't very much protein at all, even though they did exactly the same training program over time, and they were all older athletes. I think the average age was like 65, if I recall right. So protein may help both accounts. And then, as I mentioned, also lifting weights is something I really strongly suggest that aging athletes all do. In fact, I think all athletes should do it. We tend to move away from it as we get older, though. By inserting strength training programs back into our training schedules, I think it does a lot of things for us, one of which is helping to maintain muscle mass.
So I want to just jump back to protein for a second. Is there a specific type of protein that is better than others? So are we looking at red meat, or are we looking at nuts and grain? I mean, where are you suggesting that protein would be best used and then turning into the leaner muscle and the loss of weight?
Yeah, that study I read this morning that I was mentioning, they use whey protein in that one post exercise. It's a dairy product. usually in a powdered form. You can mix it into a drink. That done after a workout, especially after a strength workout, may be especially beneficial on both counts, helping to manage body weight, at the same time trying to improve muscle mass. So the standard right now has been 20 to 25 grams post-workout for athletes of all ages, and that may be even more critical for the older athlete. You may just need to focus on getting more protein, especially post-workout. But there may be a need also, according to the research I cite in the book, there may be some benefits to our eating more protein coming from really any other sources we can get. The ones that are most readily and usable by the body tend to be like animal products, nuts, those sorts of things are what we really need to be looking for, I think, for the most part. I suspect we're better off staying away from just relying strictly on supplements. Whey protein may be a good idea following a strength workout, but using that as your only source of protein throughout the day is probably not a real good idea. It's been highly processed, and a lot of stuff is taken out of it that we probably don't even know what the stuff taken out was or why it's important to us, but we seem to learn those things over time, why foods are more important in their natural state as opposed to their highly processed state. So I think protein in almost any form is going to be good for the athlete to take in, but there are certain times during the day or week when it's probably best, which is mostly after workouts.
I'm speaking with Joe Friel. He is the author of the new book, Fast After 50, How to Race Strong for the Rest of Your Life. We've spoken with Joe in the past. He is a coach. He is an athlete. And he is also, I would assume, I guess I can call you a senior athlete now.
I think he's very easy to call me that.
Okay. You know, I found something really, really interesting in the book when we were talking about diabetes. And it turns out that insulin resistance also seems to occur in domestic cats. Now, I'm not sure how that was discovered, but it was. What does it tell us about ourselves, somewhat in evolutionary terms and in a way that we can respond to the problem it creates, this insulin resistance? Obviously, that's diabetes we're talking about here.
Yeah, right. Exactly right. Yeah, the thing with the cats is interesting. In fact, that's happened with other animals also. Typically, when we feed an animal, foods that it's not evolved to eat, it develops health problems. And so if you have a cat, you know, they're meat eaters is what they are. If you start feeding the cat carbohydrate, as its primary source of calories, it's going to develop health problems over time. Humans are much the same way. We evolved over the course of four plus million years eating certain foods, and we're well adapted to those foods. And those foods include primarily fruits, vegetables, animal products, nuts, seeds, berries, and so forth. That's the stuff that we're adapted to eating very, very well. We'll thrive on those foods. If we start replacing those foods with foods we haven't had in our diet for a long period of time, as in millions of years, we're more likely to experience the same problem the cat does, which is having health problems, in this case showing up perhaps as diabetes or in other ways. So that may be something to consider also for the athlete who is looking at their body makeup. If insulin resistance may be a part of this, it has to do with hormones. And the body, when someone is insulin resistant, tends to store fat very easily. And so maybe that person, if they've tried cutting calories and still can't get their body weight, their body fat back down, may need to consider whether or not they should have quite so much carbohydrate in their diet. They may need to shift their diet away from carbohydrate because of the insulin resistance.
Okay. I mean, I certainly understand how it all happens with the processed foods and the sugars and all of the things that younger people eat, but this really affects people as they age too.
Exactly right.
Right. So the last thing I want to talk about is whether we can benefit from the ideas in your book, even if we're not planning to be competitive, because you offer plans for training and rest and recovery and competition and workout guidelines, and it's a progressive plan. Even if you're just going to do a 1 Grand Fondo a year, or if you're just going to ride your club ride every weekend, anybody over 50 should be able to get something out of this, I would think.
Yeah, I think that, first of all, people need to exercise regardless whether they follow the plans I laid out in the book. exercise is very, very strong medicine. It's stronger than any medicine you can get from your doctor. It has potential to change people's lives dramatically if they've not been exercising at all before the age of 50, for example, or whatever their age may be. It could be 30. If people are not exercised, starting to do an exercise program, regardless of any of the stuff I talk about in the book, will benefit them immensely. The more they get into it, the more vigorous exercise becomes important to their health and over the course of many, many years. So I see people who go to the health club, and they sit on the exercise bike reading the magazine, and they've got the workload on the bike at a real low level, and they're just sitting there barely moving the pedals, you know, at 20 RPM. And I know they think they're, but somehow this is magical. If you sit on an exercise bike, somehow you're going to lose weight and become healthier or whatever they've got going through their head. But it doesn't work that way. Exercise needs to be vigorous. If you're not breathing hard, nothing's happening. If you're not tired afterwards, there's no benefit as far as fitness is concerned. Now, there may be a recovery benefit. But as far as fitness, fitness requires that, first of all, you become fatigued. You can't have one without the other. You can't become fit without ever being tired, fatigued from the exercise. So both of those go hand in hand. So vigorous exercise is critical, and that's really what I describe. But I describe it in the book for the athlete. The person has been competitive for a number of years and wants to continue being competitive. I take vigor to a new level more than simply the person who is trying to be healthy.
Anybody who is over 50 would probably enjoy the book because it has a lot. First of all, each of the people, besides all the wonderful things you do have in here with graphs and information and how to, you know, how to eat, what to eat, high intensity training. But you have all these wonderful little essays by each of these many, mostly famous athletes and doctors who add a different flavor to the book from your past training Bibles, which most people who have been doing any kind of cycling or triathlon have on their shelves. So tell us where we can get a copy of Fast After 50, How to Race Strong for the Rest of Your Life.
Yeah, it should be in bookstores around the country, local bookstores. That's the first place to check. You can buy it online at Amazon or Barnes & Noble, for example. It's going to be out in ebook format in the next 2 weeks. And, you know, Kindle, iTunes, Kobo, etc. So all the formats that'll be available in just a few more weeks.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me once again, Joe Friel. Fast After 50: How to Race Strong for the Rest of Your Life. Let's all stay healthy. And it's really good to talk with you again.
Well, thanks, Diane. Enjoyed it.
All right. Have a good evening.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Bye bye.
Bye.
Joe Friel joined me from his offices. I can't even remember where he lives, but that's okay. He's south of here.
Somewhere warmer.
Yeah, well, any place is warmer today, except maybe where your sister is in Alaska. It's a cold one here. But it is a really interesting book. I liked it. I learned some stuff. I thought the thing about cats, you know, it kind of gave it more of that flavor of, oh, that's how that evolution stuff works, you know? So,
or doesn't, depending
on who you are. That's it, true.
Right.
Okay, so last thing we want to talk about before we send you on your way for the week is Radiothon. It's happening. It's happening now. Please log on to WJCU.org. Click that Radiothon button. Pledge your support. And if you don't do it this week, I'm coming after you next week. Thanks for listening. I hope you have time for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.